welcome to this week's episode of The Homeschool How-To. I'm Cheryl, and I invite you to join me on my quest to find out, why are people homeschooling? How do you do it? How does it differ from region to region? And should I homeschool my kids? Stick with me as I unfold the answers to each of these questions week by week. Welcome, everyone. Today, I have with me Chris from 6-7 Podcast. Chris, thank you so much for being here. I am so excited to talk to you today.
I'm excited to talk to you too, Cheryl, and thank you so much for having me on. I really am looking forward to this. I love this topic.
So I reached out to you a long time ago. I could say that you kind of crushed my dreams, but... but for good reason. So in my kind of awakening of things, you know, I was, you know, not to get too into politics or anything, but I was super, super liberal. And then I had this awakening of, oh my goodness, I'm pro-Trump. And I thought the world was great now. The water was fine over here. It was friendly and happy. I was happy to be there. And then I stumbled upon you, and you have a podcast. And what I loved about your podcast is that you actually back everything up with receipts, as you call them, if I remember right, because I went through them all. And you kind of crushed my dreams because you were like, listen, it's two wings of the same bird. It's two different sides of the same coin. We're in this kind of as people on our own, but together, which now I can say that I'm comfortable in that fact and getting more and more comfortable as the days go on. And homeschooling is just one of the things that I can do to be more comfortable in that fact. You know, if we can't depend on the government to make the right choices for us, we have to do it ourselves. And I think homeschooling is a way to do that. So I reached out to you many times over the last couple of years because of your podcast. It just always provoked more questions in my mind, which was awesome. And you were so nice to always answer me. And I brought you on today to talk about kind of the history of education, because you know everything else. Lay it on us.
I know a few things, put it like that. I know the more I learn, the more I know how I don't know anything. But yes.
Right.
It's funny you say that, you know, you were a liberal and then you kind of realize, oh my gosh, I think I support Trump, which in and of itself is its own entire traumatic experience.
Yes.
And then when hop the broom again to go, oh wait, they're two wings to the same bird. You're like, it kind of got everybody in no man's land, so to speak, as to what to do.
Yes.
But as far
which
as...
Which is why I came to you.
Oh, well. Thank you. Thank you. But as far as the education system, yeah, this is, you know, this is a wonderful topic. And the history of our education has been something that I've kind of been a little fascinated in, as my father and my grandmother on my mom's side were both educators. And so, you know, people would often tell me, oh, you know, there's different gifts of the spirit and teaching is one of them. Oh, you're the teacher. You're definitely a teacher. I'm like, oh, okay, thank you. But I am starting to see just how important a good, honest, open-minded, well-studied teacher actually is. So here we are, you know, here we are. So what kind of... you know, we can dive into it. Do you have a specific question, or what would you just like me to share my info on the history of education?
So first of all, I mean, we think in our minds that this being in a school building for 6, 7, 8 hours a day has just always existed. And to veer away from that and teach your kids at home is completely, you know, out of this world. But when you really look into it, it's only been around about 120 years, which, I mean, that's a couple of grandparents ago. Is that correct? Am I right in that assessment?
Maybe a grandparent or two. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's funny you mentioned that, because I was just talking with some friends yesterday about how much I believe our perception of history has been adjusted just in the last 150 or so years, since somewhere in the late 1800s, 1870s, 1880s, somewhere around then, a tremendous shift happened. And I'm still putting my finger on exactly all the things that seem to have changed around that, but education is definitely one of them. And you're right. everybody was educated at home and via a trade almost exclusively prior to the Rockefeller education system really transforming the media and the perception of education, not even education itself, just the perception of education. I use my wife's grandmother as an example. So my wife is from Sweden, and her grandmother is what's called native Swedish. So most people assume that most all Swedes are blonde hair, blue-eyed, you know, the typical Swedish look. And that is true for modern-day Swedes, but native Swedish actually don't have blonde hair or blue eyes. And they're much more, they look a lot more like Eskimos or Inuits or something like that than a typical Swede. But she talks about how her grandmother repeatedly says, oh, when I was a young girl, all we had was 3 years of school. Kindergarten, first and second grade, or something equivalent. 3 years of school that focused on reading, writing, and I think just basic math, like basic arithmetic principles. But everything immediately following you understanding how to read, write, and do basic math was all about learning something to be useful, like learning a trade. So, yeah, it's a very... her grandmother's still alive to this day. Like, she hops on Facebook from time to time. We talk to her on FaceTime. Wow. So it's like there's generations of people who are still presently alive who only had 3 years of school. And this all came before the traditional institutional school model was applied to the West. Wow. So it's not even nearly as old, this concept of going to a school for several hours, going from grade kindergarten all the way through 12th grade and then into graduate or postgraduate school. Is a very, 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 very new concept.
And you mentioned the Rockefellers. So that's really important because they started taking the oil money and saying, hey, let's give it to your educational institution. Oh, but wait, do you mind if we throw a couple of our folks on the school board? We just want to know what you're doing with our money. And then as time went on, it was every textbook said Rockefeller on it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And they did the same thing with the medical institution, and they did the same thing with, you know, several other industries, but particularly education. And so you're absolutely right. So for any of your listeners who might not be familiar with who and exactly what the Rockefeller dynasty, we'll call it, was interested in doing, John D. Rockefeller, who's considered the patriarch, if you will. He's not the patriarch, but he's definitely the one who cranked it from second gear to fifth gear and like took it all over the moon, if you will. Okay. He was an oil tycoon, and he was a pretty shrewd businessman, and he was known for monopoly, like developing monopolies in a season where there was no antitrust laws or laws against such business practice. Okay. And he basically said, listen, we got all this oil money. We need to find a way to secure how the oil money keeps coming. So he took assets and he partnered in certain cases with the Hearst family or certain Carnegie family members, like railroad tycoon people at the time, newspaper tycoon people at the time, in the case of the Hearst family. And what they did was say, listen, like you said, we're going to sponsor and subsidize these medical schools. We're going to sponsor and subsidize these traditional schools. And we would like to put members on the board of directors of these various institutions, the AMA in the case of medicine, the school board or just the general school board in the case of schooling, and ensure that our investments are being treated, you know, as any good investor would want their money to be treated, which really was, in hindsight, we're able to see a way of maneuvering the conversation so that education came squarely through this one lens and chiefly for the primary industry. So it wasn't just about like, oh, I want to control all of education. It was, oh, I want to control all of education to make sure that people don't get too smart and figure out how to innovate around my oil industry. And so that at the same time, I can create people just smart enough to work for me, but not too smart to outwork me. And that was his pretty effective, if you ask me, way of securing his financial hegemony, which to this day still runs and is still the norm. And then when you back that up with the media, the advertising, the whole Madison Avenue concept of saying, you don't want your kid educated by any Tom, Dick, and Harry, do you? You want him at a state-sponsored Rockefeller-accredited institution. And the same they did for mm-hmm. doctors. When my wife and I were first considering having a home birth with our daughter, we were learning essentially this whole hustle ran through the medical institution. You don't want mm-hmm. just any doctor delivering your baby at home. You want a certified doctor at the hospital. And that mm-hmm. concept has, like, it worked. Like, psychologically, women were like, oh, I'm clutching my pearls. I guess I don't want just anybody. Whereas from antiquity up until basically 100 years ago, everybody was born at home. Yes. And the same with education. Everybody was educated in a way that made sense for their family, right? What purpose to your family's farm or your family's heirloom food mission is you becoming a lawyer or having your MBA, right? So, wow. These things are pretty recent in development. And you almost, like, even though I've come to kind of loathe the Rockefeller approach, I understand it. I go, okay, I can see why you would do this. I don't like it. Now that I know it, I'm going to make sure my children circumnavigate your snake-like plans. But I do understand it, right? So I'm not confused by it. It doesn't leave me in a state of perplexity.
And that's so interesting. When you think about, a family business, especially a farm, if you can be self-sufficient in that sort of way, feed yourself and, we don't want your kid to keep that going on. We want you guys dependent on the government for things. So come into our here, it's nice and cozy over here. We'll give you, adversity and you can play volleyball and. All these little perks of proms and yep. And they lure you in.
Mm-hmm. And they give you a schooling in a traditional sense. And again, not that I'm knocking anybody who has encountered life through the traditional school model. I mean, you probably did, I did.
Sure, I have,
it's whatever. Yeah. It's just to say that when you know better, you do better. And so I'm learning that the fabric of it all, like the prom and Sadie Hawkins and homecoming and the football and the da 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 and all the like social aspects outside of the education is what people latch onto. It's not nobody goes, oh, but what about algebra 2 and calculus? Like nobody says that. It's all about like, no, but what about prom? And oh, well, they won't even have a traditional. Well, how will they be socialized? Right? It's all about all the things that school is supposed to do that has nothing to do with the actual information you're learning. Is to the reason mm-hmm. people latch on to what you guess at this point could be called the traditional model of school, even though historically speaking, it was not traditional at all. It's only very recent that this has become the norm.
Yeah. So you brought up algebra. I heard that they are no longer teaching algebra in certain parts of California. And additionally, they're no longer teaching cursive in certain areas as well. So I wanted your thoughts on this. My friend who's from Poland, and she came over here, after she went to college in Poland. Actually, she went to college in Germany, but she's from Poland. Then she came to America and she said, well, it's because your documents are written in cursive. If you can't read the original document, they can make it say whatever they want. I wanted to get your take on that. Because then I've also heard that the computers can't read the cursive or something. So what is your thoughts on the no longer teaching cursive?
So my thoughts on why they no longer teach cursive is because they're beginning the transition to modify the English language again and to do so with clearly nefarious intentions behind it. But more specifically, the modification is so that the narrative can be controlled. He who controls history, or he who is the victor, is the control of history, right? So if you're in a war setting, you win the war, you get to write the books on how things are. The second you can model and remodel a language, you can control and steer even that more. It was presented to me that Alexander the Great, as he's come to be known, was one of the first applications of the subjugation of a people coming by way of the changing of their language. And so he was known in infamy, or infamous for being pretty young and having conquered so many territories at such a young age. But it was because Greek was really how he did it, not war. And this Greco-Roman philosophical kind of heady conceptual kind of Plato, Aristotle, Platonic kind of verbiage model is really was his strategy for dividing and conquering, as opposed to just give me your money, you know, give me your land or whatever. So knowing that since antiquity moving forward, great strides have been made in large swaths of human control via language manipulation. Now it makes a whole lot of sense why, okay, we've got Latin, we've got English. English has kind of transformed from Shakespearean era old English into modern English. And now slang and terms and, you know, the digital world is making it possible to reinterpret and remix that language. And if you notice, computers, for the most part, don't write in cursive. So they don't type in cursive. I think some probably can, or I'm sure there are some applications that can. But for the most part, I believe it is a glyph style that is being phased out because the desire is to terraform the language again, like has happened several times throughout history. And getting rid of cursive is an effective way to do that. Plus, it just limits the student or the learner to even less options to express themselves through contract or for any other reason. While they're getting rid of algebra, it's probably because nobody needed algebra to begin with. Like, I remember, like, isn't it algebra A squared plus B squared equals C squared? Like,
right.
Isn't that like the foundational like model of solve, like trying to identify C by, like, the square root of C by combining the identifications of the square root of A and B in this kind of formulaic sense. But it's like, aside from algebra teachers, like, I'm really not sure who's ever applied algebra in a practical sense.
I mean, if any of you listeners have, please send us an email.
Please. I mean, I'm sure you could say, I'm sure there's a civil engineer somewhere that was like, oh, yes, I use algebra all the time. Or I'm sure there was like a some sort of structural or civil engineering application to it where you're trying to figure out this support beam needs this much load versus this much load. So how much, you know, should I apply? You know, I'm sure that there are isolated singular events. But as we probably can both ascertain, and if anybody who's listening is truly honest with themselves, most people, and by most I mean 99% of y'all, don't actually use algebra, trigonometry, calculus, none of that stuff in your actual everyday life. Plus, as from a trajectory standpoint, how sad is it that the model, like the systems and the computing systems we have today, which were clearly being developed and kind of planned and modeled in the late 80s and early, I mean, computers existed in the 80s and 90s, but like the idea of computing growing to the point of being able to do all the calculus for you was already well underway when people like me, who's only 38, was learning calculus 20 or whatever years ago. So it's almost like, y'all knew we wasn't going to need this. Y'all knew by the time we was adults, we was going to be like, Siri, what is A squared plus B squared? You know, we don't want to have to actually use it yet. We were still required to, like, go through the motions, take that SAT, get that, like, 800 or whatever.
There are questions like that on civil service exams. For what, I don't know. But it's not like it relates to any job. I don't know. Is it the process of thinking? But
no, I think it's like a how smart are you question. Like, how good are you at remembering things that we told you was important?
Wow,
that's what that question's
for. Oh,
do you remember the quadratic equation?
Okay,
Some old horse came a-hopping through our alley. Sine over cosine, tangent, and carry the two, and da-da-da-da, you know, like I remember my trig teacher had this whole mnemonic for remembering the quadratic equation, and it was kind of just like, I remember the fact that it was a thing, but what the quadratic equation is, how it's applicable, I'm pretty sure nobody knew then.
No, I couldn't even give you the definition of a quadratic equation, honestly.
I couldn't either. It's like that's the calculus one, I think. Maybe all my math folk who are listening, don't quote me on that. It's been a minute, and clearly it doesn't matter.
So as you bring up the AI, how do you think that is going to affect kids in school? I mean, I feel like there was internet. So, well, I don't even know when I was in college. I mean, there was an internet, but it wasn't on your phone. You had to like sit at a computer in a library or you know,
right,
dial up to AOL or something. Mm-hmm. But now, from what I understand, mm-hmm. it will write a whole paper for you, and teachers are trying to figure out ways to, was this written by a, like, so how do you think, is it going to be that kids are getting dumber or not learning what they need to learn, or are they getting smarter because they're learning the ways to get around what they got to do?
So smarter. So, okay. When you say smarter or dumber, usually those words are applied in an empirical sense, meaning someone's either collectively smarter than they would have otherwise been or collectively dumber. I think what's happening is both. Kids are getting specifically smarter and collectively dumber.
Okay, that makes sense.
And I can't even say kids. I'm saying people.
Yeah,
so
that makes sense.
Smarter in the sense of figuring out ways to find bespoke solutions for things. If I lined up 100 problems, 5 or 10 of them would be approachable in a way where the collective person is now smarter at learning how to solve them. But I believe that 90% of them, or 9 out of 10 of them, would be dumber at generally figuring out how to solve problems, because as a collective, the trend seems to be that thinking outside the box is not a skill that is being taught. Problem solving in a creative fashion, creative problem solving, where you're given a complex or simple problem and you're not given multiple choice as to what the potential answer could be, where you just have to work it out yourself, that is on the decline. Being able to apply a formula to a problem and have a multiple choice answer where one of these four is the right one, I just got to figure out, that is becoming, I feel like, easier to do, especially when it comes to mobile phones and things like ChatGPT or similar services where you can have the AI do the learning for you. But it really does seem that the point is to dumb everybody down while at the same time convincing everyone that they're smarter. Mm-hmm. So in order to do that, you have to make people specifically smarter, mm-hmm. but generally dumber. And I think that general dumbness comes as a overall lack of unqualifiable, or I should say unquantifiable things like discernment, right? Discernment is, should you trust this dude who's lied to you 57 times? This company that has made products that have harmed people in the past, are they the most trustworthy company to give you the solution so that you're not harmed today? The average person has proven to not be able to have that basic level of discernment.
We trust people wearing a white coat or, you know, in a business attire, just like the Stanley Milgram's experiment where he told them, okay, zap the guy on the other side of the curtain. And people were doing it, even though some of them, you know, they were under the impression they were dying over there, but they kept hitting the button to kill him and hurt him because a guy in a white coat told them to do it. So it is crazy. I mean, so that's not even recent.
Right. That's like old, like 40, 50 years now. You mentioned something that I wanted to highlight about people feeling like they don't have the desire to research something and they'd rather kind of outsource their trust or their decision to someone in a coat or with a title. I feel like the last 3 years, and for anybody listening, we're recording this in 2023, so you probably know what saga we're all talking about over the last 3 years. But the last 3 years proved that I think that the conditioning has become such where people don't actually feel like they're capable of researching. Mm. That's what I really saw. Like, I saw a lot of people going, okay, I want to make the right decision here. My gut is telling me I don't know that I should be afraid of this. And that very much varied depending on how much mainstream news you were watching. But for the average, right, in the middle, I don't know if I'm afraid of this to the degree that the TV is telling me I should, but I want to do the right thing. But I don't really know what any of these words mean, and I don't feel like I have the time to learn what they mean. Plus, I feel like even if I did know what the words mean, I might still make the wrong decision since this seems above my pay grade in terms of the subject matter, like epidemiology, like epidemic science. So I guess I'll defer or outsource my
ACE2 receptor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What is an ACE2 receptor? What is immunity? Like these types of things. So I guess I will defer my decision or outsource my decision to an authoritative figure who seems like he's an expert. Or who I'm told. At this point, they don't even have to seem like they're an expert. They just have to. It just has to say expert underneath their name on the bottom of the screen, and therefore, that person is in a position to give me information on how I treat my body and my children's body, right? But I really noticed this whole like, well, you should leave this up to the experts, or you're not a doctor, so how would you really know, right? And it's almost to say like, you good, bro? Like, you sitting there acting as if you're too scared to make a decision because you feel like you might make the wrong decision because you're not confident that you can actually make the right decision. It's not even so much about me. It's about you feel like you might not make the right decision, and so you're trying to warn me not to make the wrong decision because you don't think that I'm capable of discerning or educating myself to the point of being able to make a discernibly accurate decision for my own well-being and my children. And that's really what I think that the education system in a net has done. It has said you go to math class to learn about math. You go to English class to learn about English. You go to chemistry class to learn about chemistry. And then if you finish those classes and then you enter graduate school and then postgraduate school to then become an expert in one type of application of this understanding, at this point now it is okay for you to stamp expert on your chest and proceed with making decisions for you and others. But until then, so you're in debt all the thousands of dollars for all them student loans and all this, you're not allowed to make a decision. You have to sit down, shut up, and let that guy over there who did incur all that programming make the decision for you. And that's the part where I think that that's really what I ultimately think the point of the Rockefeller-inspired educational model is doing. It's saying petroleum-based products under the umbrella of the Rockefeller dynasty, these are obviously better for you. Don't ask me how, but they are. So if your decision on what you're supposed to do as far as health is concerned is not involving one of the Rockefeller products, then I don't know what to make of that, because all we've been given is the model and one way of how to solve this problem.
So I was recently in Barnes & Noble, and this is a true story. And in the children's section, there were a few books that caught me off guard. Woke Baby, Pink is for Boys, Baby Feminists 2, meaning there's a Baby Feminist 1 out there somewhere, and The Gay BCs. I had heard about these books, but I didn't actually think that they were out there on shelves. So when I came across the Tuttle Twins book series, I really wanted to show support for books that discussed matters that actually affect us, like the law, inflation, and government involvement in things like small business. Not only do I want to support a company like that, but those are the subjects I want to expose my children to, not sexuality and gender identity. I purchased the Tuttle Twins combo pack for ages 5 to 11 and also the Tuttle Twins toddler book series, where instead of learning that D is for drag, we learn that D is for the Declaration of Independence. Even though my son is only 4, I've been able to read the combo pack books with him. We do a little bit each night, and I am so impressed with the real life lessons that they teach, and also with the illustrations that make the point that they're trying to get across so much clearer. It makes it entertaining for him as well. And I'm learning right along with him. These books go over real life scenarios like owning a food truck and how hard having a small business is and how it can be even harder when the government involvement starts to take over. They talk about inflation and all different aspects of economic principles, political principles, things that are really important and are just lacking in our schools these days. The Tuttle twins have a book on America's history from 1215 to 1776, and then a volume 2 from 1776 to 1791. They also have audiobooks and books for teenagers. The author is a homeschooling father himself. And if you want to check out more of their products, please use my link, which will show them that I sent you there. TuttleTwins.com/ref/Cheryl. That's TuttleTwins.com/REF/CHERYL. You can grab the link in my show's description.
Things like naturopathic medicine, for example, or like, oh, that's a quack, you know. And that's another big thing I noticed during the whole pandemic.
Yeah,
is just how inflammatory and extreme all of the terms were. It was either like an expert or a quack. There's like, there's nothing in between an expert and a quack. Like, you're either like, this guy right here, he's a genius. This guy right here is the dumbest person on earth. And there's literally nothing in between.
There's nothing in between. Well, if you watched The High Wire, it would have been 2 weeks ago, he had on Neil deGrasse Tyson. And that was a very, very interesting interview. That crushed my dreams too, man. I loved watching Cosmos. I mean, maybe they lied to me in that too, but that just crushed.
They lied to Bill Nye, all of them. Listen, I'm right there with you because I forget. So I grew up in North Carolina in a conservative model. Then I went and worked in Los Angeles, and for over a decade was in a liberal mindset and like model. And I very much like voted for Bush and then later voted for Obama, right? So I've kind of gone like this in terms of the political spectrum. And I was actually at the Obama inauguration, right? So I had a very favorable view of the Democratic Party at the time. But I missed the Neil deGrasse Tyson generation because I was Bill Nye. And then by the time Neil deGrasse Tyson was kind of becoming more of a name in the conversation, I was kind of not into that subject. So I knew who he was, but I was like, well, whatever. And then more recently, I was kind of like, oh gosh, Neil deGrasse Tyson, like this dude is like, I'm supposed to like him or whatever because he's black and I'm black, but I could punch the mustache off this dude. Like, I just can't stand how he presents what he does. And again, I felt that way about Bill Nye and others too. So it wasn't just him. But when I saw that High Wire episode with Del Victory and Neil deGrasse Tyson, I just remember being like, bro, everybody's only here to watch y'all talk about this injectable. And you spending every microsecond avoiding talking about this injectable.
Yeah.
Cut to the chase. Like, we get it that you're an astrophysicist, but we're not. Okay. So know your audience, bro.
He goes, well, why do you have me on this show? Why are you asking me these questions? Well, because you have a documentary coming out about it. Why are you making a documentary about a subject if you're an astrophysicist? Why are you making a documentary? Yeah, that was... He actually came to a theater here like 2 months ago, and I was like, oh, I should go see him because I watched Cosmos and, you know... he tells a story about him growing up watching Carl Sagan do the original Cosmos and all that. Well, I couldn't.
This is what I know. Men are men, women are women, and we don't know what we don't know. So I look at people like Neil deGrasse Tyson and I go, he probably genuinely believes what he's talking about. And what he doesn't understand, like I didn't either, is the scope at which one's smarts can be exploited with a few foundational pieces being withheld from the conversation. And we could, you know, there's a zillion explanations or assumptions as to what those foundational pieces could be. But I maintain that the foundational withheldings are motive driven, meaning if Nelson Rockefeller just happened to not tell you, Neil deGrasse Tyson, that the entire basis for the funding of research and clinical research and peer review and things like this were always only ever exclusively to support his industry. And he just happened to not mention that to you.
Right.
But here you go, running off, drawing conclusions as to things and taking Pluto out of the planetary lineup and things like that. Because you're a science guy and you really like that. And Nelson Rockefeller, who is the gentleman who printed every single book you've probably written to get to your high accolade of academia, he was not an astrophysicist and concerned about the cosmos either. He was concerned about making money for him mm-hmm. and his folk and his children. With just withholding just that one piece of information, which isn't even politically biased. It's not like it doesn't draw any bearing on the Earth or any of the actual numbers. It's simply like, listen, we're trying to make money, bro. Like, we're trying to get this bag. We're trying to actually profit in the future. And so because of that, I'm not going to tell you about the 67 other alternatives that could explain this phenomenon. We're just going to go with this one because that drives money back. Like, just withholding that one piece of information is enough to have a whole entire rational adults grow into a field of belief mm-hmm. that is thwarted. That is, it's like a great example is, let's say, a maniacal, like brain, like mentally deranged father of a child who wants narcissistic attention drawn upon himself decides to hide his kid in a closet or in a cellar underneath the house and call the police and say, yo, my child is missing. I think they were kidnapped. Simple, like essentially in an entire missing children's investigation, that is the central and really only lie that was ever told. I don't know where my kid is. It's missing. Please help. Everybody from that moment forward is operating altruistically. They're like, oh, wow. Okay, so a kid is missing. Okay, what can we do? Put out an APB. Send out an Amber Alert. Let's get a search party. Was it over here? What were they wearing? Well, if so-and-so, what kind of van was it? Oh, okay, it was a Chevy Astro. Okay, no, it was a Dodge Caravan. Okay, you know, what was the color, right? There's all these people trying to be useful in terms of applying any sort of help that they can to the situation to get to the bottom of where this missing child is. And really, the only deceptive element of the thing is the very initial phone call that said, hey, my kid's missing. I don't know where they are. Everything past that is good people trying to do a good thing, totally fumbling into themselves and into reality in terms of how to make that happen.
I didn't know where you were going with that, but boy, you brought that right back around. That makes a lot of sense. And when you think about schooling, how much is it that you don't know what you don't know? With the schooling, how many little tidbits were left out, you know, especially around these wars, you know, we're living the whole Ukraine situation right now and seeing different sides, I guess, if you want to pay attention. There's a lot of, I mean, really all the countries in the world just happens to be where Hunter was working or, you know, like, come on, there's a lot of countries in this world. That's exactly. A coincidence, man. Like 10 years ago, we were saying, we're not delivering the pallets of money. Right, if you investigate, you know, my son's company in Ukraine.
Right.
Okay. But that's all right. You know, and then how is that going to be written in the textbooks going forward? Or is the, you know, ChatGPT going to flip that around when you ask it a question?
Going to rewrite it for you.
I mean, just this.
The revolutionary Hunter Biden was trying to solve world hunger. This is why he
through paintings,
set up a
through his good paintings. we were just driving down to JFK 2 weeks ago to go to Myrtle Beach for break. And I said to my niece, who's 20, I'm like, oh, look, there's where, you know, 9/11, there's where the Twin Towers used to stand. She's like, oh, like it didn't even phase her at all. I'm like, wait, were you alive? No. I'm like, really? What did you learn in school about it? And she's like, yeah, I know we learned about it, but she didn't even have any recollection. And then here I go. You want to know the truth? Do you want to know the truth, Haley?
Do you want to know the real truth? It's like,
yeah,
cool story,
crazy
auntie.
Aunt Cheryl.
Crazy yes, Aunt that's Cheryl.
Now, let me ask you this. So I got thinking about this the other day. We had a situation with our school. We're like a podunk town in upstate New York. But they had a whole like school shooting like thing going on there. I know my nephew, he had heard about it and was afraid to tell anyone because he didn't want to be targeted. Like he had heard that something was going to happen, but he didn't want to tell the authorities because he was afraid he'd be targeted if it were true. And it was a whole big thing. And I just got thinking about this, like these, the shelter in place drills and all this stuff that's going on in the schools today. There's got to be something bigger to that. Is there like a trauma-based thing that you think is going on with that?
Yes, I do. I absolutely do. Because I learned, like a lot of the earlier part of my research was built around learning about trauma-based mind control. And I remember seeing people explain all the time, they do this trauma-based mind control at the macro and the micro scale. So on a micro sense, trauma-based mind control is applied to an individual by physically torturing them or physically harming them and then harming them to the point of dissociation, which is really a your body's natural coping mechanism when it has a pain that has crossed a certain threshold or when a injustice is being done where it can't rationalize the why behind the injustice. So it chooses to detach your psyche from your physical body, which is known as dissociation. And then trauma-based mind control is about inflicting dissociation on a person or inducing dissociation in a person and then nurturing the dissociated half or portion of that individual over time through conditioning so that you can create the trauma on cue and then the dissociated half is a useful entity or alter, if you will, for weaponization purposes. But on the macro scale, trauma-based mind control happens when you're constantly making people afraid. I mean, even like the death counter, like the death number, the death toll that was on TV, that's a form of trauma, the macro level trauma-based mind control, because it was, you're constantly seeing people, someone's dying, someone else died. Like, look, 5 people just died in the last minute. Now, was that accurate? Probably not. If it was, it was because they were being killed, and it was being labeled as a brand new disease. But nevertheless, the mind control worked because people had developed such a fear after about 6 or 7 months of seeing death on the TV screen that they made decisions that were against their own personal well-being, or at least against their own personal gut feeling, many of them. Like, I don't really want this, but I guess I'm going to get it because I don't want to die. When that only was applicable because of macro level trauma-based mind control programming. So in the case of the shooting, like in New York, what they do is they exacerbate a potential. There have been guns since before there has been America. There have been schools.
That the shooting where the girl drove to the guys, that it was kind of near us. Yeah.
That was near you?
Yeah, we're in upstate New York.
So yeah, this trauma-based mind control on a macro scale is very effective because what it does is it instills a normal, it like shifts the line of normalcy. Here's a great separate example that totally applies in this case. And I was just having this conversation this past weekend. It is commonly understood that, when you leave your house, you absolutely must lock your door. Like at night, did you lock the front door? You got to lock it. Make sure you lock the door. Now, we were at a house as some friends this past weekend in the country. So it's anybody who ever grew up in the country knows, maybe you lock your door, maybe you don't, but you know all the neighbors, everybody's, you know, all about God and country, so if you don't lock them, whatever. But I was talking to my wife and the friends we were staying with about how people have a legitimate fear that their stuff or their safety is going to be impeded on if they don't lock their front door or they don't lock their car door. Now, again, I'm not saying don't lock your door or don't lock your car. I'm simply saying think about however old you are from the day you were born to today, how many times your car or your front door has been entered by someone unauthorized. I can think 0 a one time. Now, we have been robbed before, but it was by someone we knew. And if you ask any police department or investigative reporter, they'll tell you that most robberies happen from people you know. A strung out meth addicted nephew, some random babysitter who, you know, just random person. But most people proceed through life as if I don't lock my front door, robbers, multiple robbers every night go from house to house and just tugging on doors and you're looking so right. for the open one. And if they happen to come to mine tonight and I forgot to lock it.
Right. Meanwhile, like if it's summer and it's hot out, every window's open and all they have to do is cut through a screen.
Cut through a screen. Or if they used to work at ADT or Sonatrol or any one of these companies, just cut the phone line. And then your security system's disarmed. It's like there's a zillion ways to gain access to a house. Most people's front doors have glass mm-hmm. on them. You just break the glass. You know what I'm saying? So the reason I gave that example is because there has been, through my lifetime, again, I'm 38, a tremendous amount of movies and media and the local news, Anson County Sheriff, there was a highway robbery, a house robbery, da 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 da. So you hear it on TV, and everybody who's sitting at their house in the county that's adjacent to the county that the robbery took place is all like, oh, wow, crime is going up in my neighborhood. So if I don't actually lock my door and set my alarm code, all my stuff's gone tomorrow. And the truth of the matter is that if you never locked your house a day in your life, 99% of y'all would still right. have all the stuff in your house. Why? Because robbers don't just go to random houses and look to see which door is open. That's the quickest way to get arrested. Furthermore, they don't know if what happens behind your door is of any value. So most police will tell you that robbers are either strategically looking for, like they're either like posing as the AC repair guy or the bug repellent Terminator man or whatever, gaining access to your house to scope it out, then later coming back to hit in a targeted fashion. It's not random, and it's certainly not every night robbers are just going from car door and house to try to open it. Oh, this one's open. Hey, come in. Let's get out. So this type of social
Maybe in Chicago.
Maybe, right. Maybe in Chicago. But outside of Chicago, everywhere else, again, I'm not suggesting people don't lock their doors. I'm just saying if you had to tally up in your life how many times the door was not jiggled or the car alarm did not go off because some random stranger was just tugging at the door handle trying to open it to see if it was unlocked. The answer would be 99.999% of the time, you never would have technically even needed to lock your door because nobody was trying to steal it. But if you ask the average American, oh, you got to lock your door at night. What are you talking about? You're crazy if you don't. You're crazy. What are you trying to get robbed?
It's interesting because when you think of like when the mass shootings are reported on the news, a mass shooting now is anywhere where four people are killed or injured, right. It says. Mm-hmm. And I just read that the other day. Killed or injured. So wait, if four people get like a bruise because a gun hit them on the head, is that a mass shooting? Oh, yes. I mean, how are they, why are they, obviously I know why they're wording it this way to make it so that there are more mass shootings. But why do they want to do that to us so that we succumb to just kind of their protective powers?
I think it's that. And I also think that it's like a lot of people would think that it's to campaign about removing guns. I'm one of the people who don't think that that's the reason. I don't think they want to take Americans' guns at all. I mean, I think in an idealist world, they could say, yeah, give us all your guns. But outside of the fact that they know we don't live in an idealist world, I don't think they want to take them at all. I simply think that they want people to be they want gun owners to be afraid that they're going to be taken so that they're more readily ready to use them against their neighbor. Oh. And they want non-gun owners to champion the cause of why we shouldn't ever need guns so that a dialectic exists, two extremes, yeah. like the expert and the quack exist. There's no middle ground. There's nobody that says, oh, yeah, you want a gun? I don't have one, but if you want one, sure. They don't want that. They want people like, you shouldn't have guns, and you're evil if you do. Or they want people going, I got 38 of them, and I'll shoot you if you step on my porch trying to take them.
You're so right, because the divided fighting people will not come together and show their government that we can survive without you. If we're Correct. Fighting, we're divided.
We're divided.
And that's you brought me to that conclusion, you know, a couple years ago with just some of the things that you had, videos that you had on your podcast and answers that you had to some of my questions. And cool. It's so true. I see it everywhere now.
Yeah. If you're divided, you're not fighting, or you're not fighting together, I should say.
The premise of my podcast is, you know, why are people homeschooling? How is it done? What are all the different ways you can do it? And how does it differ from, you know, state to state? We all have different laws. And should I homeschool my kids? And as I was thinking about this with the shelter in place, you know, the having like my nephews go through this experience of, oh, there is someone threatening, that's traumatic on its own. But even the shelter in place drills, those are traumatic on their own. So if I send my child to school, do I think they're going to get shot and killed? Probably not. Like you said, if you leave your door unlocked, they're probably not coming into your house and stealing your stuff that night. So they're probably not going to get shot and killed. But is that the point? No, the point is I don't want them to go through a childhood of this trauma-based mind control where they are doing shelter in place drills, or they hear something from someone else and have to feel that they have to go tell an authority, but they shouldn't tell an authority because they don't want to be targeted. And that is all trauma-based mind control. Right. And do we want to put our children through that?
I know the answer. No, I don't. That's another thing that I think people, like the homeschool conversation, doesn't even factor in. I'm glad you brought that up, is because most people are thinking about the educational aspect or the socialization aspect, but they don't think about the trauma-based mind control that comes with bullying. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, that's like, it varies state to state, city to city, school mm-hmm. to school. But the drills and the like federal mandates that schools are required to, you know, more or less put the students through. Now we have things like, you know, it used to be No Child Left Behind, but you have critical race theory education. There's all kinds of like new types of problems to really assess that mm-hmm. weren't even like things that anybody would have thought about years ago. And I get the impression that a revolution is coming, because what's happening is that you can't put people under a oppressive model for too long. The masses do revolt. There's nobody that just gets oppressed into oblivion where you just cower into yourself and then you die off as a species or as a people group. That doesn't happen. What ends up happening is revolutions and coup d'etats and all kinds of different things happen so that the governing model is changed once the level of threat or oppression gets past a certain either amount or past a certain length of time. So I love the idea, like, you know, I have a 3.5-year-old and we 100,000% are homeschooling her. But I have come up with what I think is going to be, at least I'm going to stress test this, my initial approach to homeschooling, starting in the preschool days, that I would absolutely love to share with you and just get your thoughts on it. Because, you know, I wasn't homeschooled. I went to traditional school. But now, you know, there's no question. I don't even think I'd send my daughter to the same school that I went to, because I went back to my high school during the pandemic. And I looked around and was like, y'all are just complying with every single mandate, dictate, and situation because you have to, even though you're private, so you don't technically have to, but you have to. And I don't want my daughter to be a part of this. Plus, you know, I had a great athletics program and things, but as an individual with a little bit more of a hands-on approach, I could have even provided a better I can provide a better situation for my daughter than was provided for me. Not that I think my parents did a bad job, but simply because I now know more. Mm-hmm. So my model and my approach is this, and I'm going to call it, I think, the 5-minute school, the 5-minute classroom or the 5-minute school session. And the idea is that every day there's 30 things on a piece of paper that we learn about. But each one of those 30 things, we spend about 5 minutes on. I think this would scale as she gets older with these little kiddies' attention spans. You know how that be. So what we will do, and I've already done this a couple times. When we'll go to the playground or to the park or something, I'll be like, okay, so today we're doing 5-minute school. So you have to think of 5 things you're interested in learning. And in my day, I take my daughter, who's 3.5, and I stop what I'm doing. And I talk to her, squat down, get on her level, and educate her on the things that we see in and around on our life. And we make it a point to have a number so that it's not just about like, oh, today we didn't do anything, tomorrow we do 5 things, the next day we didn't. It's every day it's a certain amount of things. And an example I'll give you is we're going to the park and we see a fire hydrant. And I go, okay, 5-minute schooling, fire hydrants. So we go up to the fire hydrant. I'm crouching down. And I'm like, do you know what this is? No. Okay, this is what's called a fire hydrant. Can you say hydrant? Okay, hydrant. Let's spell it, right? So we're dealing with spelling. We're dealing with phonics and enunciation. And then I go, do you know the reason this is here? Well, I don't know. Well, the reason this fire hydrant here is because if somebody's house catches on fire, then the fire trucks will need a place to get water in order to put that fire out. You know that fire and water don't really work together when you have a fire, unless it's a grease fire. You put water on it, and that's how you quench the fire. Oh, okay. So, yes. So, this hydrant is yellow, and why is this one yellow? Why is the one over there red? Do you know that the different colors mean something different? Oh, I didn't know that. Yes, the yellow ones have a certain pressure. The red ones have a little bit more water pressure. The orange ones and the green ones, like the colors matter about how much pounds, like what the water pressure is. And we'll take 5 or so minutes and just no phones, no. And it's just me and her talking directly about a thing. And it could be literally anything. Because I thought about that one day. I said, you could teach your kid a lot about the way this world works just by stopping, crouching down, getting their attention, making them focus, and just looking at whatever it is, a mailbox, a doorbell, a tree, a bush, a construction car, the little green box where the telephone equipment goes, like anything. And so what we try to do is every day we have a series of things that we try to take 5 minutes school. And we're learning about this fire hydrant in this example. And then once we got that done, we're good to go. And what I noticed is that like a week later, she's like, Daddy, fire hydrant. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right. This one is orange. Like, oh, yeah, or yellow rather. Yeah, no, yeah, you're right. I was like, remember what the yellow means? And then these are moments where you can reinforce the things you taught them. Yeah. And sometimes we revisit the same thing. But I'm thinking, as opposed to an 8 hours of sitting, learning about an abstract application of a thing, why not take a few minutes, be it 5 or 10, or if they're older children, maybe 15 or something longer, and you're learning all the different, you're learning language, physics, English, you know, construction, all these things.
In one,
about a specific subject, about a specific object, I should say. And that's kind of what that's been me and my wife's approach. Like, okay, we're going to start this because we're definitely going to do curriculums and workbooks and more homeschool type things when she's older. But at least now we're like, let's start it with this 5-minute school idea.
Yeah. And some people don't even add the workbooks. I mean, maybe in high school, but when they're young, there's this whole unschooling approach, which is very similar to that. And I love that so much. I mean, market that and target that as your own, put the stamp on it. But, that's awesome.
Cool.
And it brings me back to thinking, you know, I talk on the podcast a lot about my son being, he's in a preschool right now, 3 days a week for 2.5 hours. And that has been so eye-opening to me. And a couple weeks ago or months ago, they sent home a letter. Hey, we're working on letters. They're 3 and 4 year olds. And they're like, get the flashcards out because the kids really need to learn their letters. So I'm doing these flashcards. Colin, what's this? I don't know. Okay, well, it's a T. 2 minutes later, Colin, what's this? I don't know. It's a T. It's not getting it, right? Yeah. And I presented it on the podcast and talked to other parents. And they're like, yeah, no. One, it's got no context to him. And two, he's just not ready. He's 4. He's just not ready. He has no desire to learn what a T is. If you, you know, wait till he wants to read instructions on how to build a monster truck and then he needs to know what a T is so we can read the directions, then he's going to want to know. He's going to say, Mom, can you help me read? And it's so true, too, because I thought to myself one day, does he know why he's got to know the letter T? Because, like, does he know it has a sound attached to it? And then all the other, you know, 26, 25 other letters, they have a sound. When you put the sounds together, it makes a word. And the words together make a sentence. And the sentence together makes, you know, a story. But that I don't think they explain that off the bat. I don't remember them explaining that in school. It's just, here's letter A. And then you learn A is for ah. Or I love when it says A is for ah. Like, what does is for mean?
For, right.
A
yeah, exactly.
Is for.
A is what? 4, but I thought 4 is 4. Like, what do you mean A is 4?
Yeah, A is for apple. But no, apple begins with A. That would be the proper way to say it. But even A is for apple, it doesn't even make sense as a sentence. And we're expecting these little kids to understand.
Right, that's such a great point. Plus, they can't decipher between F-O-R and F-O-U-R and F-O-R-E. They don't know homonyms yet. So, yeah, that's such a great point. A is for apple. B, or like the, and then you have like
it's
the
crazy.
Like the vowels all have a long and a short sound. I was an English nerd, so I really liked that stuff in school. But my mom was really the one who was like challenging us every day. All right, today we're learning a new word. Before we even went to school, what's the word of the day? And she would bust out the dictionary and pick a random word and like, today's word is this. And we'd have to learn it. And when we got home, she would ask us. So she was kind of like augmenting our schooling with homeschooling at the same time.
Oh, that's awesome.
We're younger. But I really do think, like, I think that I would be willing to bet that back in the 18, 17, 1600s, before this institutional model of school really came about to be, that they really did have to get creative with how they introduced this stuff to their children. Because here we are. I mean, as far as I know, all of our grandparents made it just fine. They, you know, they survived to whatever great or extent or not that they needed to in order for us to be here. But it's become obvious that the model of for traditional schooling has been about spinning tires and burning out one's resources on things that don't really technically apply. Or even in the case of the A is for apple, like giving them information in a not intuitive way, often much earlier than they actually need it, just so that they can pass it a form of accreditation, which really is like, I need you to learn A is for apple so that I can teach you, you know, an apple a day keeps the doctor away so that the apple industry can get their money, you know? As opposed to teaching you how to
put
plant
some pesticides on it.
Exactly. So you can go buy these Monsanto apples, and then that way you can get the doctor, your ulcers can get exacerbated by tongue or tin. So then you got a GI issue, you got to go see the specialist. So it becomes it becomes an instructional model for maintaining a money flow in a cyclical way. Not for growing and nurturing a child or an individual to be the best and most innovative human they can be. I mean, I think there's even a famous quote about, like, I don't want a nation of thinkers, like a Rockefeller quote about how he does not want a nation of people who can think at all. He wants a nation of people who can work.
Yeah, I have it somewhere here, too. Okay, Alwin Toffler, he described the origins of the current education system in his 70s book, The future shock that the American education model, as well as what was practiced in India and other parts of the world, was actually copied from the 18th century Prussian model designed to create docile subjects and factory workers. It consisted of three courses: punctuality, obedience, and repetitive work, the basic training requirements to produce reliable, productive factory workers. But yeah, you're right. The other one, I don't want a nation of thinkers. I want a nation of workers. And that was he created the General Board of Education. Yep, the Rockefeller. Rockefeller poured a significant amount of investment into the education system, created the General Education Board for $129 million and said, I don't want a nation of thinkers. I want a nation of workers. So, I mean, right there.
That's all it took to take over the Western world.
That was a lot back then.
I mean, you're right. You're right. But it's like, even the fact that it is any finite number is like the crazy thing. But, you know, what do they say? Punctuality, repetition, obedience, and repetition. That's what school is. Mm-hmm. If you're like, oh, if first period starts at 8:30 and you're not there at 8:30, that's a problem. Like, your parents will get talked to, or you'll get a detention. And if you're not obeying, and there's like, you know, of course, there's just the general unruliness that nobody can learn if there's a disobedient child. But repetition, oh my goodness, this idea that say it again, repeat it again, memorize this. Okay, memorize it, and then we're going to the next chapter. Take the test. Okay, you took the test. You got a 95 or whatever. Okay, great. We're never going to ask you that information again. It doesn't matter to me if you knew it, if you know it from as far as, you know, now for the rest of your life, because you set it on a test and we've tested you for it. And now that's in the past. And so now we're moving on to the next thing you have to memorize. And you can just see this Prussian model is for sure what has been applied to the current education system, because now that I'm an adult, I don't remember exactly what the quadratic equation was used for, even though I remember it was a thing, and I don't even remember technically the formula, but I got an A on the test at the time because I needed to get my GPA right to get into school I wanted to, so that I could pay them some more money. And that's a whole separate conversation too, the whole like student loan kind of thing, like the trajectory of graduate studies and postgraduate studies that almost require you taking out a mortgage or some sort of small scale mortgage in order just to pay for someone to teach you something that's going to be ineffective by the time you're actually graduating.
Yeah. And I didn't realize those loans are paid off by our tax dollars, like right off the bat. So when people don't pay their student loans, the school's fine. They've got the money.
The bank's fine.
The school's not hurting when I didn't pay my student loan. It's the taxpayers, because they're all taxpayer backed. Right. So it's just, so we want student loan forgiveness for what? We're gonna pay ourselves back. We already paid for it.
It's all talking points and narrative. It's sad, but it is. And I think that it's good that you have this type of podcast where people who are either new to homeschooling or who are entertaining the idea of homeschooling, or who aren't but are kind of like wondering if they should, can kind of like start to think about some of the things that we, generally speaking, aren't allowed to talk about when the understanding is that, oh, no, you got to have your kids in school and you got to start them right at basically kinder, like pre-K. And if the school isn't rigorous and doesn't have this type of collegiate level, this and da 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 da, and master's this and honors this and AP and IB and international baccalaureate and all this stuff, then it's not worth investing your time into. Because I see so many people come and give me a number just as an estimate of the people in your life and just your sphere who work in a profession that's unrelated to what they went to college for.
Oh, I'd say most.
Right, me too. 90. Most people, definitely over 50. 90% of people I know have a job because they need a job, and that job is not directly tied to their collegiate profession. Now, mine, ironically, is. I didn't expect this to be the case. I kind of fell into it. I started college as a computer science major. I thought I wanted to do software development and programming. but I changed majors to mass media and communications. And that encompassed things like branding and production. And technically what I do is production. But I can tell you with 100% certainty that one could do the type of job that I do and have never gone to high school or college, because the things right. that I've learned to do the work that I do now for my job, I did not learn in school, even though technically the major was related to the industry. It's simply that the industry just changed so much since college mm-hmm. that I could have just taught myself all this on my own, like I already did, without the college, and been just fine. And had I stayed in my initial major. Or on the job training, correct. Had I stayed in my initial major, I think about this a lot, because I graduated college in 2006. So I graduated high school in 2002 and college in 2006. And had I stayed.
Yeah, we're the same.
Okay, cool. Had I stayed in my computer science primary software development major, immediately after I graduated college, the very next summer, the iPhone was announced. And later, the iPhone was announced in July of 2007. And then by December of 2007 is when it was first launching. And I worked at Apple at the time, so I very distinctly remember the initial iPhone launch and how chaotic but exciting that was. But I remember thinking at the time, wow, had I stayed in my major, I would have had to relearn an entire operating system coding language, because everything prior to mobile operating systems and just like mobile phones taking like a smartphone turn was all like just custom system on a chip stuff for Motorola and stuff like that. So it was kind of its own little category. You learned C++ for basic computing. You learned Unix for basic like networking environment stuff. But all of that stuff took a backseat to what they considered Objective-C, or, you know, more kind of like streamlined C++ in the case of mobile computing. So I remember thinking, I would have graduated in 06 with a whole engineering degree from an engineering college, and the very next year would have had to turn around and learn an entirely new engineering language because Steve Jobs just decided to come out with a new phone. So I remember going, mm-hmm. what a waste that, like, had I stayed in that, what a waste that would have been, because I would have had to basically relearn everything on my own, which I could have just done without the college. Like, I had to take chemistry in college. That was just a required whatever, just, even though I was in a chemistry major. Right.
Core requirement.
Totally could have gone without that, right? I had to take, like, I took sociology in college, which I liked, but if I had not have taken that sociology class, I'm pretty sure I could still have edited a video. So it's kind of like I'm learning. It took me getting out of college and seeing the market change to go, technology is changing too fast to assume that anything you're going to learn now and in 4 years is going to matter in four, like after 4 years or in 8 years or in 16 years. So right. I just, for that very reason, that's when, even before I had a daughter, I was like, okay, I'm going to have to rethink this whole education thing when it comes to my any children that I have, because I just don't think that it actually matters. Like, I don't think that what I learned in school, even though I liked school, has any bearing on my life as an adult.
So now let me ask you this. So you talked about, you think there might be a revolution coming down the line and, you know, you are going to homeschool your daughter. What do you think it is that our kids need to know by the time they're around 18?
They need to know how to learn. They need to know how to think, for how to derive at independent conclusions that aren't like groupthink. And they need to know how to learn things. They need to learn how to learn things, meaning if you're 18 and I kick you out the house, all right, adult, you're an adult, go be an adult. The very first thing they need to learn how to do is go, okay, I need to learn how to get a house. I need to learn how to file a this or complete a that. And I think that our current education system is woefully under-equipping people at learning how to learn. Google, how do I do this? Enter.
Yeah.
right? As opposed to saying, what are the elements of how a thing works? Who owns a thing? Might the motive for somebody who is financially benefiting from this type of outcome be different than someone who isn't financially benefiting from this type of outcome? What does it mean for me as a consumer if I want to be informed on something from someone who isn't financially benefiting from this? Okay, how do I see who financially benefits from this? Okay, how do I have discernment enough to weigh the value that this product is to me compared to the value of this product to that other individual? This person's benefiting from it. So of course they're going to see it as valuable. That person over there has a different product that they that is completely unrelated to this. So they're not benefiting from this person's product in the same way financially, but they might benefit in other ways. Where do I sit? So they need to be equipped with the notion of individualism, that they are their own person and that they can arrive at a thought in a way that doesn't have to be modeled after some sort of institutional model, and in a way that that equips them to know that their own worth matters, right? There's just so much of this whole, like, well, we're the collective, the common, the global citizen. Like, we need to make sure that all of our decisions benefit the world at every time. Now, again, I'm not sitting here suggesting that we be selfish narcissists and that our decisions don't benefit the world. I'm simply saying that I plan on equipping my children to make sure that they understand that them and themselves are a part of the greater collective. So the greater collective is benefited when they are benefited. And if something is being marketed as a benefit to the greater collective that is not a benefit to you, you don't have a responsibility to anybody else before you have a responsibility to yourself. Now, service and sacrifice and giving of one's good, like, that's a completely separate thing, right? That's a virtue that's separate from the logical deduction on how to determine what's actually helpful for me versus the greater good. And I saw that, like, exploited in the context of this pandemic, where every decision was ostensibly made on behalf of the greater good, when it turns out that if the decision harmed you or put you at a deficit, and also you, and you, then how on earth could that ever benefit the greater good? It was just a marketing line. They just said that. Oh, I don't want to kill somebody's grandma. Okay, got it. Sure, I don't want to kill somebody's grandma, but if it kills me, and then I still am something that I have to incur as a risk. Why do I need to take the risk on behalf of the hypothetical grandma you have when time will tell me that the risk that I took doesn't pose, like, that doggone thing didn't even stop the transmission? You see what I'm saying? It's like that. So much of that was exploited in the case of this injectable, because we were all told that the masking, the injection, all these things help the greater good. They lend toward herd immunity, even though they stop using that word and just want to pretend like that thing doesn't even exist anymore, despite the fact that everybody seems to be fine and every other virus in the past, once you get it, like once you get measles or chickenpox or whatever, you don't get it again. Herd immunity seems to be a whole thing over there, but not with this, right? So because they spent so much time focusing on psychological manipulation tactics like, oh, you just need to do this for grandma's case, I think a lot of people fell into a problematic situation, or at least a less than ideal situation, because they literally put their own well-being to the side for the hypothetical greater good. But that only applies in like I'm going to give up my 5 loaves and fishes to feed the 5,000 or something like that type of sense. It doesn't apply. Like, if everybody's personal well-being is being diminished, there is no the greater good because we're all collectively at a deficit here.
That was a Nazi tactic, I believe, that the collective matters more than the individual. If you were to say, like, well, I need you to go in and steal everything in that Jew's home, this is for the greater good. I mean, they're diseased. We you know, but we could use their stuff. And I think even George Soros, he admits to being one of the people that would go into the Jewish homes and stealing the property. He said, well, it's just what they told me to do. But it was for that was a collective good. You know, there was a disease over there. We had to take the things because they're valuable, but, you know, leave the people, they're not. And it was a collective idea, just not collective for, you know, unfortunately, certain people. But
it's
but
like, isn't that funny how the word collective gets selective? It's collective, but not for everybody. It's like, it just goes to show you how, in terms of science, psychological sciences almost matter more than chemistry and physics and stuff like that. It's stuff Neil deGrasse Tyson talks about. Because whether Pluto is a planet or not is significantly less important than whether my nervous system is going to presently break down because I put an experiment that I didn't know what it was inside my body. You see what I'm saying? It's like both of them are sciences, but one matters significantly more to the present reality of us all compared to the other. And I think they treat them, school at least treats them on equal.
When you question me, you question science.
Right. And that's why I couldn't stand it when the founder, he's like, well, you know, science says. Science. It's just science. It's like that word doesn't, I don't think, since science. It's like, I'm pretty sure that's not what's happening here. In fact, I haven't seen you apply the scientific method once here, buddy. Mm-hmm. Plus, you said at the beginning, a mask is just giving you the illusion of science. It's not really mm-hmm. protecting anything. The reason I knew he was a charlatan is because I read the article, a scientific study that he was one of the co-authors on that talked about how during the 1918 Spanish flu, the majority of people who died did not die of the flu. They died of bacterial pneumonia. And the paper didn't really draw giant conclusions as to what caused bacterial pneumonia. They were just saying that most people didn't die from the actual flu. They died from bacterial pneumonia. Separate papers were including and purporting that covering and blocking one's airway and rebreathing your, you know, germs or whatever your body's meant to eliminate is one of the chief excrements, correct, is one of the chief ways to exacerbate bacterial pneumonia. So I'm sitting there going, mm-hmm. well, you can't be an idiot and get this position. So it's clearly, you understand that since you wrote the paper, most people died from bacterial pneumonia and not the Spanish flu. So how is it that you haven't connected the dots that doing this for 3 years is going to trigger bacterial pneumonia or other complications? And, you know, it was a very mm-hmm. short leap from there to be like, oh, wait, I'm pretty sure you know that. You're just actually trying to facilitate that. And you're in a position of authority where you say one thing on 60 Minutes, and then when everybody actually went through and half the people obeyed with the double masking, and they still got the thing, what does that mean? Does it mean that it worked, but you still got it, or does it mean it didn't work, and therefore this expert was either wrong or flat out lying to you, right? If I'm an expert, do I still get to call myself an expert? Right, because again, who's defining what this, like, it's just so many things we can break it down, but it's to say that people were exploited because they trusted something or someone that turns out was untrustworthy.
So at my son's preschool, they didn't even tell parents, but I happened to overhear them kind of say in the very beginning, oh, and don't worry, we put hand sanitizer on them all the time. And I said, I don't want that. And I wrote a letter, and like whenever it said, you know, does your kid have allergies or this or that, I said, I don't want him having hand sanitizer. And they asked me on the first day, does he have an allergy? And I said, no, we just don't want, if his hands are dirty, can he just go wash his hands? And so he had to tell me he was, you know, just had turned four at that time. He had to come home and tell me one day, Mom, you know, they do put hand sanitizer on my hands. So I had to say something again to the, or no, I think I made him tell the teacher to tell her no. But I was listening to a podcast today, actually, and this woman, Sophia, somebody, she was talking about how they used to put DDT on children to, oh, it's going to get rid of, I don't know if it was the polio virus or whatever, but they used to spray the kids, you know, outside, we got to spray you because you're all going to get polio. And then they find out, oh, wait, that causes cancer. And I was like really relating it to that because that's been one of my biggest qualms, that why are you putting this on children without their parents even knowing about it? Because I said to another mom that they're doing that and she goes, what? I don't want that on my kids' hands. I'm gonna write them a letter. Well, where do they, when we send them to these institutions, where do they get off thinking that they have the right to put something on our child, to put a chemical on them without even consulting us or with just no care in the world?
You know, that's such a great point, but I think it's just the individual teachers or the individual faculty that are like, we want to help, right? And again, I think that everybody, doesn't matter what side of the pro or anti, and they go, well, hand sanitizer, we don't want germs on their hands. So we're going to sanitize. But that's because some marketing department at Purell somewhere said this kills 99% of germs, and that's a good thing. And we're going to put it with pleasing music and with a narrator who's got an authoritative tone to his voice. I'm going to say, don't let your, you don't want to be such a dirty, you don't want to spread disease, right? Right. Okay, great. Use our product so that it kills, quote unquote, 99% of germs. And what people are never told in that conversation is, okay, first of all, it uses a very dangerous process of killing these germs. And second of all, the claim can be made that it kills 99% of, quote, germs, but it kills 99% of everything on your hand, including the good bacteria that your body needs to identify when there is a threat. So this is not even like the school's problem or like the science's problem. This is a communications issue that bears a bigger, at the end of the day, this is a responsibility issue whereby people allow solutions to be applied to their children that are non-solutions, that technically are problem exacerbating non-solutions. And the hand sanitizer is a great example because that stuff is straight up poison. I don't know if you've ever seen those videos of people lighting it on fire. Like they took a glob of hand sanitizer and they take a match to it and like light the whole piece of paper on fire and it just burns for like 5 minutes. It like burns forever and it like never burns off.
No.
And it's clearly creating toxic byproduct when they burn it, I'm sure. But it's an interesting thing because you're like, yo, we're literally putting like flame gel on our hands and is killing our body's ability as a first line of defense to know that there's viral or other microbial threats because that bacteria is designed to assess and address those things and those external threats. And if those external threats become a certain level of threatening, they then kick into activation mode where they're telling our innate and adaptive immune system, hey, kick into high gear and get your stuff together. We got a threat to deal with. But then when you remove that, you have no advanced warning system. So I look at that and I go, whose fault is that? Is that Purell's fault? Is that Fauci's fault? Is that the school's fault? Is it the parents' fault? I don't know. And at the end of the day, I always just settle on, because you can't really know, it boils back down to you. It boils back down to your own responsibility to learn what is good and what is not, what is beneficial. Learn all angles to a thing. That's why I said earlier to your earlier question about what children need to be educated in. They need to learn that if this hand sanitizer, they need to learn about how to learn about hand sanitizer. Because we know what marketing is. I work in the marketing industry, and I can tell you, I can make literally anything seem like a good thing. That's kind of what we do. But people need to learn that marketing is a thing, and that a marketing pitch is not a scientific experiment, and it is not giving you all sides to a potential product. It's giving you just the side that the brand manufacturer wants you to know. And when you know that, you can then take that information and go, does this benefit me? Is this something I need? Do the pros outweigh the cons? Yes. Okay, then I engage in it. No. Okay, then I don't engage in it. You know, greater good or not, you know, like that's all notwithstanding. Because I maintain that there's nothing that can really be for the greater good if it's individually harming. If it harms the individual, and collectively individuals make up the greater populace, then unless we can, unless we're talking like an anomalous thing, like, oh, okay, well, certain people are allergic to this, but most people aren't, then I just have a really hard time empirically accepting anything could be for the greater good that's for that results in an individual diminishing or harm, you know, the diminishing of an individual's health or the harming of an individual's health, psyche, well-being, happiness, or whatever.
That is well put. I think that circles it around and pretty much gets almost all of the questions I had for you. So we're on an hour and a half now. So I will free you up so that you can spend the rest of the evening with your lovely family. I can't thank you enough for coming on today and like helping me all along this three-year process. Really, you've been an integral part. I've shared your stuff so many times. I've used your receipts for documents. I've probably lost friends on Facebook sharing your science, your scientific receipts, but it's been so helpful. And but everybody I share your stuff with loves it. And thank you so much for doing what you do and for just having such a way to present it so that it makes sense and is practical. You're going to be a great teacher for your daughter.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And you're very welcome. Thank you for having me on your podcast. And so we can talk about homeschooling and from one homeschool parent to another. I'm telling y'all, if you're on the fence about it, you happen to have friends or someone who share this with you and you're considering it, just understand that ain't nobody going to love your baby like you love them. And ain't nobody going to teach your baby the things that you can teach them, seeing as how they're actually like half you, right? They're you and their father, me and their mother. We know what we need best. Now, I'm not an expert in certain subject matter, so I certainly will reach out or collaborate. But I think that most people assume that school has to be this like master class in life. Not even in life, just masterclass in data. And it really doesn't. It simply needs to be, who is your child? What do they need to move into the next phase of life? Once they've got reading and the basic stuff down, like letters, you know, I think a lot of people are starting to see the value in moving into a more hands-on or at least like subject matter on approach when it comes to educating your own child, because then you can actually be the voice that has the most influence in their life and not a school board or curriculum or heaven forbid John Rockefeller.
Oh, thank you so much. That was beautiful. I think I'm sold.
Here we go. Homeschool by the way.
All right, Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Homeschool How-To. If you've enjoyed what you heard, please consider helping me out by sharing this podcast with friends, with your homeschool community, and even to your favorite homeschool group Facebook page. As a new podcast, we're really trying to get our episodes out there so that we can keep going. Also, if you'd like to be a guest on the show and tell us about your homeschooling experience, email me at thehomeschoolhowto@gmail.com or visit thehomeschoolhowto.com and send me a message through Facebook or Instagram. Thank you for your time and for your love of the next generation. We'll see you next week.